CITR 101.9 FM. Good morning. It's 2:30. I don't know what his DJ name is, but we've just been doing a little lesson of mixing there. This is the End of the World News Early Late Edition. And what we're going to do now for the next just about an hour is an interview I did on the weekend with a producer of a movie in England and also a writer by the name of Robert Wakefield, who's making this Orwellian despotic movie in Manchester. And here is what we did. If it plays... Okay, yeah. So this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and we're trying a new one here for my show. We're doing a Skype interview with the author, Robert Wakefield, who is in Salford, Manchester, or Salford next to Manchester, I should say. How are you, Robert?
Hi, Andy. How are you doing? All things.
It's a Sunday afternoon, and we're working hard, or a Sunday evening for you.
The first thing I like to say is he seems a long, long way away, like Salford in the UK.
Yeah.
But at the moment, there's a great link between Salford and Vancouver, because there used to be a totem pole that stood on Trafford Park Road that was which came from Vancouver Island and was brought over here with the Manchester Shipping Company. Anyway, in 1969, this totem pole was taken down. And recently, some of the Indians from Canada have come over. They've restored the totem pole. And this year, it's going back up again.
So we're gonna so we've got a direct link between the fair city of Salford, home of the Smiths and lots of other bands who people who listen to this show know.
Yeah.
And you're fine.
Your contact, Jeremy Cooley, is available.
We don't care about that, robot. We just want to talk to Robert. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I heard that, yeah.
Yeah.
But no, all I'm saying is it's absolutely fantastic that we've got this link that's going up right at the moment, and just that we can talk on the radio as well. Well, this link with the totem pole is like a link from the past that's going up to show that, you know, the totem pole is a symbol of Canada's past.
Yeah.
And it's also...
Well, also, and also currently as well, because there was a lot of stuff done for the Olympics, I guess. There was a lot of carving done by native tribes, people, in art projects, etc. You know, and it's a dying art, I guess, in some respects, but, you know, we're trying to keep it alive, right?
Yeah, what I'm saying is, like, you know, you got this totem pole that's going up at the moment, and it's like a direct link between ourselves, you know, and Canada yourselves,
which is good.
We're very glad.
I can tell you, we're glad.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is, like, in Salford itself, if anyone in Canada just goes and puts in the Salford totem pole, you'll absolutely see how the people in Salford have actually got right behind this project. There's loads of articles on it. There's loads of interest in the newspapers and all this kind of stuff. And the people of Salford are proud to have a link to Vancouver and Canada itself.
Good. So, I mean, so the reason we've got you on the show, Robert, is we had you on about, 6 months ago, was it?
Yeah, it was about 6 months ago, yeah.
Yeah, so we're getting an update on how the community-based film that you're making, which is called... I can't remember, but you'll tell me.
Well, it's called The Year Zero.
Okay, I knew it was The Year Zero. I just want you to say it.
Yeah, it's based upon a book I wrote a few years ago, which is about a utopian society, all down to, like, George Orwellian brainwashing and all that kind of stuff, and the police state, and all the stuff you can see going on in the real world today. If you just go and read some of the articles in, you know, on some of the websites like prisonplanet.com and that. And this book actually highlighted a lot of the modern-day technologies that some people are still not aware about the very chip, about RFID technology, about the scanners that have already gone in the airports and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
But this book is it starts off from the worst perspective that could ever happen about a person that's been brainwashed, that's living in basically...
Your contact, Juhu, is available.
Sorry, we've got the robot telling us when people are available, but we'll just continue. Sorry, Robert, you were cut off there, mate.
Yeah, well, basically, the book's about the worst that these police states and their societies can do do to us. And it's about the spirit of man himself and his soul. And how, as human beings, looking after each other and, you know, protecting each other and sticking together, we can survive all this and come out of it smiling. And I don't really want to spoil the end of the book.
Yeah.
But the book is like an international bestseller. But
how many roughly have you sold of this particular book?
At the moment, about 60,000 copies.
So I want to give a bit of history on this one. Now, you're an ex-RAF chap.
I was in the Royal.
You were in the Royal Air Force, and you were also, you still are, a prison officer. You were with Troubled Youth.
I was a prison officer until 2007,
yeah.
And now work the probation service.
Which is really a branch of the prison service, isn't it? It's part of the Home Office.
It's a trust now.
It's been public privatised.
Yeah, it's been privatised like everything else. But
okay. And you're also a writer. How many books have you written, Bob?
I've got 4 books written, and I've got 2 books being published this year.
When are they due out, mate?
Well, one of them's going to be coming out very, very soon, and one of them's going to be about in the summer. The one that's coming out very, very soon is one of what I'll talk about in the second half of the show called Say. But the 4 books I got published, the first one I got published was a book called The Knights of God, which is a story of the First Crusade, which has an interesting side issue, which it tells the story of Godfrey of Berlin, who is the descendant of Queen Elizabeth, George Bush, and all that kind of stuff. So if you want to know a bit about before the Knights Templar and all that kind of stuff, it's a really good, interesting read. And it also tells the horrors of the First Crusade.
Okay.
Then I read a book called Legacy, which is the story of the main calendar stones. And then I written a book, The Year Zero, which is basically a science fiction type novel based on the Book of Revelation, and I've written a children's book called The Crown of the Seven Kingdoms about a group of kids who find this ancient scroll and they decode it and they follow these light clues, hoping to find treasure at the bottom of this mountain, and they end up going into a gateway and they end up in a world between heaven and hell. It's a bit different than the normal Harry Potter's and that. It's a really, you know, thing about a fight against evil with the kids as well. Like, you know.
So it's not based in devil worship like Harry Potter or something, as the religious right in America contest.
They actually go into a place that's a divide between heaven and hell, but they're actually on the good side, trying to protect us on this side of the plane.
We're on this side of the plane, and they're on that side of the plane. Tell us about the movie and where you're at with the movie. Now, the movie of the book is called The Year Zero, and you started production of that about a year ago, if I remember rightly. You started getting people together in the local community, and that's the thing that really interests me, is that it's a community-based collaborative affair.
Well, yeah, we started off about a year ago, and the movie's got so much interest that we've got like big bands, like a punk band from the 80s that were as big as the Sex Pistols and the Clash, called Sham 69. We've done the theme music for it for free. We've got Panasonic, one of the big companies that helps us out, you know, with the filming and the cameras and stuff like that. But this year, we've not actually started filming yet, and hopefully we're going to start filming soon. We're just short on a bit of the funding.
Yeah.
Now, we will have the funding from myself in July, but I'm hoping to get some funding
before
then.
You want to get something done before that. Now, you were saying, we did this interview yesterday, so we'll go back over that in a moment.
Yeah.
Now, if people wanted to fund your movie, i.e. they want to buy in to have a collaborative effect, I don't know if you can hear the Harley in the background, noisy Sunday riders here. People can go to piratemymovie.com, which is Max Kaiser, the economist, and they can also go to your site and donate.
Yeah, which is, it's www.yearzero.page.tl. If you go on that website, you can actually just get in contact with me, basically.
Okay.
Do
you have a PayPal account or a chip in or anything like that?
Well, there is a donate button at the bottom of PayPal thing. If you want to just put, I don't want loads of money on people. I just want them to give us the price of a cup of coffee or something for coming on and watching the clips on there or something like that. You know what I mean? But if you want to contact me directly and purchase a piece of equipment as a sponsor, and especially if you've got a business or something, then we can really, really highlight businesses.
I think what I'm trying to get at is that, like, the whole point of the collaborative thing, you've got support from the community, but you've got very little support from kind of central government art funding and all that sort of thing. You're a purely self-funded movie, which is what, you know, most movies that actually turn out to be any good usually start out that way, and then maybe get picked up by
It's the heart and soul. It's the heart and soul that's in the movie itself, and the making of it, and the people that have got involved in it. And these are just ordinary people that got loads and loads of talent. But we've got people like, there's a guy called Richard Harris who comes and gives us technical support. Richard Harris makes a program in the UK called Blood on the Wire. He's wrote scripts for Doctor Who. We've got a guy called Martin Kay who comes to the shoots. He won a BAFTA award for The Jewel in the Crown, his film Coronation Street, his film Cracker, and all that. And he comes and he teaches all the young college and university kids, you know, extra tips that they never learn anywhere else. We've got some brilliant people, you know, who are natural actors and actresses, you know what I mean? Yeah. And they come
there's a definite Salford feel to it, isn't there? There's a definite, like, you know... I can't remember the name of the film, but it was it Winky Park? I can't remember what that... You know, there's a definite northern feel to this movie. That, you know,
the feeling is from people themselves, because everywhere you look at, you know, around the world, there's a sense of anger and annoyance with all these doctrines and things that are being imposed on people. And people can come into this project and you know, use their creativity.
Yeah.
And use their creativity to, you know, and
to
use
try and, to try and better their lot, and also to bring awareness to what's really going on. Even though this is a story, what's being portrayed here is actually ongoing within these communities and within our community here in Vancouver, you know, or in BC. We see these same sort of draconian footsteps tapping away.
It should be done not just like with the movie I'm doing, it should be done in all walks of society, because when we get together as a group, and it's something I've organised, it's just, you know, everybody just loves the day. They're just all laughing, they're all smiling, they all feel as if they're on top of the world. And all it is, it's just ordinary people getting together and doing something that's absolutely, you know, awesome and magnificent. And if everyone just went to work with that sort of feeling that you're all working for each other and you're all looking after each other, and the whole world would be a different place. Okay. But at the moment, everyone just seems to be working to, you know, you've got to pay all these bills, and you're getting hammered all the time. The bills keep rising and people can't afford to live anymore, you know. And no one's, if you look at any government policy, like the elections in Britain at the moment, there's not one single party saying how they're going to actually help the people.
Yeah,
there's not one party.
What I'm seeing, we talked about this yesterday, is the cult of personality has been transferred from the Obama, Clinton era, Bush era, whatever, and it now seems to be raising its ugly head in the UK, and policies are not being talked about, but we're talking about whether Gordon Brown's a good man, or whether Cameron's a good man, or the third runner. Now, on that note, you're also running in the local elections, right?
Yeah, I'm running as a local councillor. I'm standing as an independent.
You're a busy lad, Bob. You're a busy lad.
I am a little bit. But the thing is, there's a group of us that are standing as independents, and we're trying to, run out of town the Labour Council that's done nothing at all for Salford or for the people of Salford. So we've all stuck together as a group, but we're all independent and we're all free-thinking. And the council offered us £8,000, which, you know, because we'd formed this group, but we told them we didn't want that. You know,
so you're self-funding your election campaign as well, right?
Well, every single leaflet comes off my printer at home. You know what I mean? I do all my own walking. You know what I mean? You know,
yeah, you've got no press agent and no PR people, right?
We're just doing it absolutely, like, you know, on our morals. You know what I mean? We're just going, look, we're going into this, and we're going into this, you know. And the other thing is, we're the only single group that have put a manifesto out. out of the Labours, the Conservatives and all the big parties and even the little parties were the only ones that actually put down in writing what we're going to do or what we're going to try and fight for.
Yeah.
Now, one example of that is the French energy companies that now control the UK energy wanted to impose an 8% rise on the French people.
Do you want to set up why they did that, though? Because what was going on with Sarkozy and the, you know, the basically what happened in France is that the populace said no, and we're not taking an increase in power. So the multinational who now controls the grid in Britain decided that they would then impose that loss of income to the corporation on the British taxpayers or the British consumers.
Well, the British public.
Yeah.
Yeah, so our domestic bills then went up in that 1 month by 17%. Yeah, because Sarkozy capped it to 4% for the French and said, we're not having this rise. So the company said, we can't get it from the French, so we'll just get it from the British. So the British people are now supporting the French domestic fuel bills for them, which is completely unfair and unnecessary and just basically wrong.
Now, to give a bit of history, you were running for UKIP, right? In the past, you ran under a UKIP, United Kingdom Independence Party, and as we were talking about yesterday, one of the problems with UKIP was that it was based in Brussels and trying to get a change in the oligarchy that is the EU. But what you've decided, from what we were saying yesterday, is that to bring it back down to the grassroots level and do something locally, right?
Well, the thing is about UKIP. UKIP was absolutely fantastic. I've got nothing wrong to say about UKIP.
No, and I'm not knocking it either. I agree. But
the thing about it was their battle was to stop us being involved in the European Union. Now we are fully under the umbrella of the European Union.
Yeah.
That battle's been lost. Yeah.
So
by standing as an independent, I have not got no party affiliation or anything like that.
Okay.
So when I stand and become a council leader, I can start doing whatever I want to do. I can say whatever I want to say.
Sounds like a dictatorship if you can do whatever you want and whatever you say, but go on. I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah. But I can start pushing forward. The main, you know, they may not get passed because you've obviously all got to be voted in, but I can start putting policies in. You know what I mean? I don't have no party whip over me or nothing like that.
Okay.
And I can say, hang on, let's go and take these energy companies to task.
Yeah.
Let's go and petition of all the people in Salford and say we're no longer willing to pay this price for this fuel.
Now, how much of what goes on in Salford is really a mandate from Brussels? Like, percentage-wise, would you say 60% of the policies and dogma that comes down from the UK central government is actually coming from Brussels?
Well, all I can say is it's really hard to know that, you know, off the cuff.
Yeah.
But the thing, all
I'm
can say
you
is
the hard ones. You're not going to get easy.
No, but every single leaflet that comes through your door from the Labour Party, you now control this council, are not promising one single thing. There's absolutely nothing on their leaflet to promise you anything, because they know even because they run the council, they now have no power or no authority in Salford at all.
So what I guess what I'm trying to get to is how much of it comes down as a central government dictate and then is filtered through the local currency of the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, it doesn't really matter who, becomes then policy. And in actual fact, if you were able to trace it back, you would see that it's coming down as a central policy from the EU conglomerate, right?
Well, like I said, according to their leaflets, it looks as if it's 100%. 100%. They have not got one. You know, they have not got 1% of power anymore. Everything they do is dictated to them from above, from
central government, and from that.
Yeah.
Parliament is just a knocking shop, a talking shop.
Everything in Salford as well, like the housing, the council housing, like, you know, I don't know what they call it in Canada. I don't know, it's the same
public
kind of thing.
Housing. Well, it's called low rent public housing. We have essentially the same thing on a lesser degree, because Canada didn't have the clearances of the 1940s and 50s, you know, after the Second World War, where Britain had a housing shortage, so they built lots of public housing under what was a Labour government, and, you know, under Attlee or whatever it was, whoever it was.
Well, all them kind of companies, like your housing, have all been passed on to private companies.
So you've got lots of public-private partnerships going on, which is kind of corporatism, for want of a better word.
Well, basically, he's passed in the book, so like they can charge whatever they want, and you've got no recourse to appeal against it to the council.
Do you still have any rent controls? Are there any rent ombudsmen that give the, you know, like the poor to middle class working, you know, folks of Salford? Do they have an ability, if there's a rent increase, do they have anywhere to go to argue the toss, or is it just comes on down?
Well, in Salford itself, you've got two companies. You've got a company called City West, and you've got a company called Salix Homes. Salix Homes, if you're lucky enough to be in a council house that's owned by Salix Homes, your rent is quite reasonable.
Yeah.
If you're unlucky enough to be in a house that's run by City West, you're paying extortionate rates for living in your council house. So it's like even with something that's supposed to be fair and equitable and was run by the council when everybody paid the same rate. It just depends what housing association you're with now for how much you actually pay.
So within the UK and within Salford, you've got to, because this is something that you know, it is quite peculiar, I think, to the UK, that they've really in the last 20 years moved to these public-private partnerships in a big way in everything. So the infrastructure, the prison service is privatised. You're working for the Crown Prosecutions or whatever, and that's privatised. There's a huge movement to corporatism, but under the auspices of it's done underhandedly, and the vast majority of the public are not aware that this is what's really going on.
But all they're doing is they're selling it to these private trusts, you know, all these private companies. And so you as an individual can't go to the government and have any recourse. You can't go, you know, and say, hang on, a group you get together and say, hang on, this is wrong. Because as soon as you go to the council leaders, you know, or you go to the government about the rise in the energy bills, the rise in the fuel bills, the rise in your council, you know, rent and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
As soon as you go and bring these issues up, they can just turn around and put one hand up into your face and say, hang on a minute, that's a private company now, it's got nothing to do with us. But the same thing again is that the government aren't actually fighting for you. They're not going, hang on, this is too much, these energy companies are ripping everybody off in Britain, we're going to do something about it. Not any of them are saying they're going to do anything about the rising costs, even though the price of oil has come down, the price of gas has come down, electricity is virtually created for free, but they still want people to pay for the nose for these things. There's a scheme going on in New Zealand. It's gone on for many, many, many years, where when someone comes out of the further education and they get the first job, New Zealand government buys them a house, and they pay that house back at very, very low interest. Now, they can sell that house and pay the loan back off to the government, you know, move on.
Yeah.
But they make sure that every citizen in their country has a house. Now, this is one policy I thought of just in Salford itself, because there is a housing crisis, is you put £1 million aside, you can build about 40 houses for that.
Okay.
Yeah? Yeah? The first thing you do is you end, a bit of the recession for the builders, you know, because you're creating jobs. Yeah? You're creating jobs for landscape gardeners. You're creating jobs when the people move in the houses, they want to buy suites and they want to buy, you know what I mean, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but these people there.
So you're moving the economy on somewhat, right?
Yeah, and then these people are actually paying back a low rate mortgage to the council. And
as opposed to a banker bailout mortgage to the bankers in London or New York or whoever.
Other thing is, these people then cannot be repossessed, because you'd have a clause whereas if they fail to pay the mortgage or the money because they've lost the job, became redundant or something like that, they can just revert to council house status, where the state would pay for them until the time they got a job again. And then the other thing about that is, you move down the line and the money starts coming in from all these like mortgages that the council have given out, they can then build more houses on the same scheme. And then it ends up that everyone ends up owning the own home.
Well, I mean, that was one of the things that Thatcher sort of sold to the public, was the ownership of of private companies, but in actual fact, what it did was just increase the corporatism, and, you know, it was a big bluff, really.
Well, what they wanted to do was get rid of the energy companies and sell them off to private companies. And so you have no recourse for when they set the price of the bills. Because these governments now, if they still had full control over the energy companies, knew they would lose the elections.
Yeah.
But now pass the buck over to a private company.
So they can take the inference and say, well, we've got nothing to do with this, and let's move on to our new policy of building windmills and solar power.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I haven't got any particular evidence of this, but I'm pretty much convinced that the British government still own the majority shares of most of these energy companies that they've sold off to.
But, does it mean you've got to go to a company's house and go looking at their... or in the case of, like, Tony Blair, where he doesn't actually report his earnings and then says he's short, so he needs $5 million a year just to tick over?
Yeah, well, and they can't even afford to pay for his train fare, you know what I mean?
Is that the latest one? He can't pay his train fare?
No, about 6 months ago he got on a train. He had no money. But anyone else would have, like, you know, been on community service, and I'd be supervising him, but not Tony Blair. He just gets off away scot-free with it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you've got your movie, and that's a community-based thing. You're running for local council, and you did mention yesterday you were thinking about running as an MP.
Yeah, he's still up in the air, if I'm going to do it or not.
Because that's a huge undertaking, mate.
There's a guy actually running in Salford at the moment called David Emery. He's a really nice and decent lad.
Yeah.
We've had some really good private chats and conversations. I think I might put in my support behind him.
Okay.
We've had a couple of email chats tonight.
Yeah.
And I really like the guy, actually. And the people at Salford should get behind this guy, because his actual party, or what he's called his campaign, is the Hazel Blair's Must Go campaign. You know what I mean? You know, which is our MP that's with...
Yeah, well, Hazel Blair's has got a trailing line of debauchery behind her. And I'm sure that she won't be sitting in the seat much longer. Didn't she get took out of the... wasn't she in the Council of All the Good under Blair and then Brown?
Well, yeah, and she was heavily involved in the expenses scandal, and tried to bluff her way out of it by paying a minimal amount of the money back, as if everything's okay. But, like, you know, if any of us committed fraud, any ordinary people committed any kind of fraud like that, you'd be straight to jail.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can't understand. You know, they have these laws, and they say, you know, the law, you know, is for everybody. Mm. You know,
but it is.
But they created these laws.
As it's shown in Canada and America and most Western societies, the laws these days are, you know, like Obama with his healthcare bill was actually written by the drug companies and the, you know, the controlling oligarchies and these funders, whether it's Wall Street or, you know, Tibb Street or the Square Mile. You know, these people are all in cahoots with each other, as we see all the time in every country. Wait 10 minutes and a corrupt politician will be on the front page.
Well, that's it, yeah. The other thing I want to talk about as well is a bit of a side issue, but...
Yeah.
But everything that's going on in the world, like, I'm quite a good researcher, yeah? That's why I'm quite a good writer, because I love history and I love going back in the past and studying stuff like that.
Well, I was going to go back to the Year Zero and kind of the roots of... the Kabbalism and the that was where we were going to go to next. So we've covered the current state of affairs in Salford and the politics. Let's go back to what the controlling power brokers are really all about, which will hopefully infuse my listeners to go and check out Robert Wakefield, the author, .com or something.
Well, I'll start off with a little short story.
Yeah, go on.
Me and my friend Dan, and we were going down this this new road that's built in a little village in the Meath called Caddyshead. And we go through this new business park, which is called Pyramid Park. And as we go to the end of Pyramid Park, there's a roundabout there. And on this roundabout, you've got two triangles. And on the top triangle, you've got Pan the Devil with the dancing girl. When I seen this, you know, we were both looking for, you know, like, what the hell's, you know, someone like that doing here? So then, you know, when I got back, I just Googled pan, you know, on the net. And, you know, you find out it means pan spreads panic in desolate places. So you're thinking, well, you know, the place where this has been positioned, you know, could not be any more desolate. So it's obviously been designed, you know, to spread, like, fear and panic. Yeah. So, like, moving on from that, there's a big shopping centre that's been built in Salford called the Trafford Centre, which I now call the Temple of Doom. And as you go to the main doorway, which is called the Orient, you've got three huge statues above you. One's the god Apollo, one's the unicorn, and one's the griffin. So then again, you go home and you think, I'll just Google this and find out what all this is about. So anyway, when you look at Apollo, he's the god of Hades, which is basically Satan. And then you look at the one-armed beast, which took me a little bit of sussing out, but the one-armed beast, the unicorn, is the one-armed beast mentioned in the Book of Revelation, which is the Antichrist. And then you go next to that and you've got the griffin, which in mythology comes down and tears you to shreds if you try to steal any gold off the elite. And under this, you have a Logan. He says, hold fast, all which is good.
Which now, that's a Masonic term, isn't it?
Well, what it means is keep out everything that's good that comes into this domain. Yeah? So you think, well, you know, well, why have they got that?
And this is this is a shopping centre. This is not this is not a Masonic temple, but it is a Masonic temple for the ones who know.
Well, that's it. But after that, like, once you walk through the main portal, you come into the light and you've got all these ladies holding up the torch of Lucifer at you. And then as you go through there, you go into the food court, which is all nice and dark. Now, there's loads more things in the Trafford Centre, more than that. And I actually did a documentary, which you can go and watch for free on YouTube.
Now, you know what I told you about that, though, Bob? I expect a better version by next week, by Thursday of this week. Because it's unwatchable. Yeah. I've got to tell you straight ahead, mate. You know, I'll always call it as it is. The problem is that you focus in and out, and it's... It's really disconcerting. Unless you've got a better version up there, I don't know.
Yeah, there's a better version, better version.
Send me the link and I'll put it on the website.
Okay, well it's called Satan in the City.
Okay. Right, so if you go on YouTube and search Satan in the City?
Yeah, parts 1-4.
Okay.
Yeah? There is a little intro one we did quite a bit ago.
Yeah, that was the one that you sent to me and Danny.
Yeah.
Our South American correspondent.
Yeah. It's actually updated and it looks a lot better now.
Okay, good. I'll check it out after the interview.
Yeah. But going back to that anyway, so all this stuff was happening. And then in the middle of Manchester, we got this building built by Channel M, which is the local TV station. And it's all built of glass and it's shaped like a phoenix. So then you go do a bit of research on the phoenix and you find out that the phoenix rising through the flames is the symbolism for Satan. And then you go back to this Trafford Centre, this shopping centre, and you Google Earth it, and that's shaped like a phoenix. Yeah?
So just to kind of put this into perspective, Manchester and Salford are these, you know, well-established from the Middle Ages onwards cities that have got a history of Freemasonry running deep with all these buildings with these esoteric connections and symbolism that the vast majority of the public are unaware of.
But once you see one of them, you know, you start uncovering loads. And if you go and watch the documentary, you'll see quite a few that I've you know, put up on there, you know, with a camera. Yeah. But we've actually took photographs of over 3,000 things in Manchester and Salford. But the book is not actually about what we've discovered in the architecture.
Yeah.
I thought I'd go bit of research, go a little bit deeper, and you have to go to the Bible to go a bit deeper, you know. And when you get to Adam and Eve in the garden, like it says that Adam lay down with Eve and she conceived Cain and Abel. Now if you actually look in the Bible for anyone who's a father, like later on it says Adam begat Seth, which was his first son. And if you look at Adam's genealogy, he doesn't mention Cain and Abel as being his sons or from his line of descent. So the only other person that was in the garden was the devil.
Ah, there he is again. Yeah.
So it was the devil that gave birth to Cain and Abel. And this is what original sin is. Now another thing you have to think about here as well is that later on, Cain has a wife. Yeah?
Yep.
Right? So if Adam and Eve, right, didn't have any children, but Eve had two children with the devil, where's this wife of Cain come from? If they're supposed to be the only two people on the, you know, on the earth at the time.
Okay.
So the actual story of Adam and Eve is not the story of the first people on the earth. It is actually an account of the original sin, right?
Which could be construed as an allegory, or it could be construed as, you know, real physical, this actually happened. You know, there are those schools of thought that believe, just to throw a spanner in the works, that, you know, all the three major religions in the world are all based around the similar sort of ideas, right?
Well, yeah, but the other thing is, like, when you get back to Genesis as well, when it says that Adam comes out of the Garden of Eden, he's chased around by all these other tribes for a while. So then you get, where do all these other tribes come from? You know what I mean? So when you look at the story of Adam and Eve, you get told by the church and everybody else, it's about the root of mankind and where we all came from. And even when you look at the book of Genesis itself, it contradicts itself. You know what I mean? This is the point I'm trying to make.
Mm.
And the other thing is, it says that Eve ate of the fruit. Now, ate of the fruit in Hebrew is the word nagash. Yeah? Now, the word nagash also means seduced by. So Eve was actually seduced by the serpent, or seduced by Satan.
Okay.
So there's another link to say that this original sin was Eve laying down with Satan and having two children by him. Now, you move along a little bit further from that, and then you get that Abel, knowing that he's born from original sin, tries to make recompense with God and says, "Thank God, you know, it's not my fault, God. It wasn't me, you know, that did this. It was my mum, you know, and all that kind of stuff." And then, yeah, then, you know what I mean? So then Cain gets jealous and ends up strangling him to death because Cain's influenced by his father, the devil. Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah, you go further on down the line, and then Cain ends up marrying his sister called Awan. Yeah?
I think there was a lot of that going on at that part of time.
Right.
Which kind of brings us into the bloodlines and how they interbreed, right?
Yeah. Well, this was the first ever incest account, but it's not actually in the Bible, this. You have to go to the life and story of Adam, or you have to go to the Book of Jubilees to look up this part of it, yeah?
Okay.
And that actually goes into this link where these tribes amalgamated, and the link from Cain actually became the tribe of Dan. Now when Cain murdered Abel, God said, "We'll put a mark upon you." Now, in the Bible, it doesn't say it's the mark of Cain, just as "I will put a mark upon you."
Mm.
Yeah? So, like, Cain became involved in this, the tribe of Dan. So, wherever they went, there was something named after him. So, when he was in the northern part of Israel, the river, the Jordan, which is shaped like a serpent, was named after the tribe of Dan. When they moved into Egypt and became known as the Hyksos, and they ruled over Egypt for the reign of six kings, they formed the town called Dendera, or, you know, Dandera. After that, they were kicked back out by the Egyptians, and they came over to Greece and became known as the Danans, and they formed the river, the Danube. You know, so you can see...
As the Greeks moved out and spread their empire north, they became the ruling families and the ruling... elites of modern, what became modern Europe, right?
Well, and there's another thing that goes, just to go back a bit, like, it's to do with all the symbolism I've been talking about on the pictures and that, is one of the symbol of Manchester is the bee. Yeah? And on all the bins in Manchester, you've got the bee.
The buzzy bee.
The Labour Party symbol in Manchester is the bees over the globe. Yeah? If you go in the town hall, it's all covered in bees. Yeah.
So this
is where you've got a modern day and an ancient connection, and in the book it explains all this kind of stuff, you know. But like when you get back to one of the most famous personages of the tribe of Dan was the Samson Delilah story. Samson made a prophecy to the Philistines. He said, "From the eater will come sweetness." Anyway, the story actually broke down that Samson had killed this lion with his bare hands. He'd gone back there a couple of weeks later, and the carcass of the lion was lay there, and inside its stomach, the bees had formed a nest, you know, a hive.
Mm.
So as Samson approached, the bees swarmed away, and he went and ate of the honey. Yeah? And this prophecy was broken down as once the Lion of Judah, which is Jesus Christ, would have fallen, then the bees would transform over the earth and cause a new golden age or a new new world order or satanic age or whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
But it's the same symbolism as that.
Okay.
The other thing, when you get to the Da Vinci Code and they're going about the Merovingian kings, a lot of the Merovingian kings, the brothers were called Samson, which absolutely proves, without doubt, a lot of other things as well, that they actually came from the tribe of Dan and not the tribe of Judah.
Okay.
So there's no way that the Da Vinci Code has got any relevance at all or significance. But there's one interesting thing about Leonardo da Vinci. He also used to work with codes and anagrams, and his name, right, broken down, has the word Dan in it, the word six in it with V1, and the word CI with the We Are Here. Yeah? So just moving on a bit, I'll explain what the six means now. When you move on a bit further, this tribe of Dan, they move further north, and they ended up settling in Denmark, and they became known as the Vikings, which is the V1 kings.
Who moved to, Newfoundland 300 years before, the Italians landed. In America,
Yeah, so they became known as the Vikings, the Six Kings.
Okay.
And there's archaeological evidence for all this, because there's a solar disk with the Egyptian goddess Nut on it, been found in Viking hordes and stuff like this. And I have the links in the documentary and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so can we jump forward a little bit to 2012? Because you had some interesting theories on 2012 that you wanted to kind of postulate out to the universe.
Everybody thinks of the 21st of December, 2012, 11:11 hours, when the winter solstice comes into play, that the that's going to be the end of the world because of the Mayan calendar stone. Yeah?
Mm.
Now, the Mayan calendar stone was given to the Mayans by a god called Quetzalcoatl. Now, Quetzalcoatl was the feathered serpent. So basically, you've got the wings of Lucifer and you've got the serpent, which is the devil. Now, the devil gave them, a lot of stuff. You know, he taught them astronomy, he got them to build these calendar stones for him. Now, there was a guy called Albert Einstein, a very famous physicist, and he had a theory of relativity. The theory of relativity in one of the experiments was to shoot a ball of light around in a circle at the speed of light. He proved in this experiment that time travel is possible. But to explain it a little bit further in a more simplistic term, he said if you got a person and you shot him round at the speed of light in a circle, he'd get back to the same spot to see himself taking off again. So he could be in the same place at the same time, proving time travel is feasible. His distractors at the time, though, said there will never be enough money to build a machine to do this. And... the technology will never be available.
Okay, but that brings us forward to the Hadron Accelerator, which is in Switzerland or France or Switzerland, France.
Well, before that, you've got to think that if God does everything in circles, you've got the seed, the tree, the leaf, the fruit, it goes back to the seed, you've got the cycle of the planets, the circle of life and all that. So if Einstein, just a sheer man, had the possibility of sussing out this kind of physics, then you presume God, who's supposed to know everything, would have sussed that out. So if he's gone around in a big circle, he's already been around, he's seen everything that's going to happen. So that's why, you can explain Revelation, you can explain the prophets, you can explain all this stuff, because God's already seen it all happen. So if you're Satan, and all time is predetermined, and your end is coming, and you've had this calendar stone built to work out when your end is coming, then what you need to build to defeat God is a time machine. So as you say, in Switzerland, they built this thing called the Hadron Collider, which just happens to shoot a ball of light around at the speed of light, exactly as Einstein said, which has cost £4.4 billion.
Yeah, but it keeps breaking, right?
Well, the first time it broke down, according to the Daily Mail, and you can go and Google this yourself, the direct quote from the scientist was the only feasible way this machine could have broke down is if someone from the future had come and tampered with the machinery. Now, that was from the scientists themselves that work on the project, but actually basically admitting that it is a time machine. Yeah.
Okay.
But the thing that gets me about all of this as well is the company that owns the Hadron Collider is called CERN. and their corporate logo like it's 360s. You know what I mean? So, like, you know, it's like saying, well, we built this time machine to, you know, let our boss escape, you know what I mean, before 2012 comes, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and we've even got his numbers as a, you know, as our company number. Yeah. But there's a lot more to do with that as well. I mean, the second time it broke down, a bird picked up a piece of bread, flew along, and like some out of the dam busters, dropped it. It went down and hit about 20 different shafts and just happened to hit this certain piece of machinery that broke it down. Now, the other week, they did apparently have a successful experiment where they did collide these two atoms.
I mean, there is actually quite a move against the Hadron Collider. A lot of scientists on the opposite side of the equation have said that this is extremely dangerous, much like before the atom bombs were exploded in the desert and then in Hiroshima. You know, they were concerned that, you know, the atmosphere may implode, or they didn't know what they were doing, right? But science always wants to go forward, you know.
Well, it's such a dangerous, it could create a black hole, yeah? Now, they say they're trying to recreate the Big Bang Theory. So a lot of people say, well, how can it be a time machine if they're trying to recreate the Big Bang Theory? But the Big Bang Theory is the manipulation of time and space. Because it's all right being able to travel through time, yeah? Which, you know what I mean? So if I was stood here and I travelled back 10 years, I'd be, you know, I'd still be sat in this chair because this chair's been here for 10 years, you know?
Yeah.
But to travel through time and space is to disappear to a different dimension as well. So I could disappear to a different dimension and someone would be sat on a rock on the moon. So you're actually not only doing the feasibility of changing time, you're also able to, after manipulation, to move about wherever you want as well. Which is the perfect thing if you want to hide away from someone who's looking for you. Which, if you're Satan, you know that the creator's trying to get hold of you. It's the greatest escape mechanism. So, but like I say, it's only a theory. It's nothing approved, but it's just something I looked at.
Okay.
I just found it's just, you know, with the experiments and that. Yeah.
So we've got the film, we've got the book, we've got the theories. Where does it all take us?
Well, at the moment, like, I'm just finishing off Satan and the City. It's actually, he rewrites the history of the world from a biblical perspective, because a lot of people read the Bible and they don't really, you know, they sort of read it and they sort of like skip through it, because when you start reading some of it, it says, you know, in those days there was giants in the earth. And most people go, hang on a minute, what's this all this bit about being giants in the earth? Yeah?
Mm.
And then it says when Moses didn't enter the promised land for 40 years, he couldn't enter the promised land because his spies had said the Nephilim were in the promised land. Now, the Nephilim were supposed to be the offspring of the fallen angels, and they were supposed to be giants. Yeah?
So this is kind of the 12-foot-high aliens or shape-shifting... I mean, I feel like I'm in an episode of Coast to Coast here, Robert.
Well, if you just go on Google giants and then just put the reference turkey or something like that,
okay.
There's a 6-foot femur bone that's been found in Turkey. 6 foot, as tall as a man, just a femur bone, right? And it's in a museum in Turkey. If you go to giants and Google the New York Times, you'll find about 20 to 30 articles from the 1930s onwards till about the 1950s when they put the block in it, when the Rockefeller Museum went over and started to take all the relics away so people couldn't find them. There was 16-foot, 18-foot, 20-foot giant skeletons found all across South America.
Now, okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a moment, because I'm sure people listening to this at 8 o'clock in the morning will be going, Goulash has lost his mind. We're in the twilight zone.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the things that kind of gets me is a lot of this stuff tends to be somewhat a distraction in some ways, because people get caught up into the, you know, the crystals and the vibrations and the time travel and all the rest of it, and that takes our attention off what's going on by the same people who we perceive or know to be evil are perpetrating on us all the time, right?
Well, you see, this is the link, you see, because when the Romans first invaded Jerusalem, one of the Roman generals said we took this place because of the grace, you know, of our God Jupiter.
Yeah.
And one of the rabbis says you've not took it for the grace of your God Jupiter. It's because our God has forsaken you. So this general got a bit, you know, like, you know, upset about
it. Yeah.
So the rabbi said, come in and show you. And he took him into a cave and he's shown him 2 40-foot giants. The skeletons are 2 40-foot giants. And he said to him, look, these are the people we had to defeat in the promised land to own this land in the first place. When you've got the story of David and Goliath, Goliath took 4 stones with him because Goliath had 3 brothers. The town called Gath, right, which everyone said didn't exist, has now been found.
Okay, and
now is found to exist. That they've actually found pottery with Goliath's name on it, right? So this is a big thing that we are getting lied about at the moment. And if you just got to go Google the giant stuff on the web, and you'll find it. Now, the question people should ask him: where did these giants come from? The giants came from when the fallen angels came out of heaven, and it says the sons of God lay down with the daughters of men. Yeah. So when these fallen angels, made love to the women of the earth,
then they became.
Now, one of the devil's main things that he tried to do at the time, when he was in a physical form on the earth, was affect all the DNA, was destroy God's creation, was destroy all DNA, right? And this is why you've got all these things like minotaurs and centaurs and unicorns and all these weird beasts, because he was interbreeding and interbaiting everything to completely destroy, mess up God's creation, yeah?
Okay.
So that's why God created the flood and protected Noah, to protect the DNA seed of mankind, yeah?
Okay.
So once, you know what I mean? Yeah? But the devil had already had his plan B in place with what I was talking about before with the Garden of Eden, because he'd already got his DNA seed, you know,
in the children of man.
Yeah, in the children of man. So this war, right, and you can go and Google all this stuff for yourself and just look at it, and you'll find as much evidence as you want, because it's all coming out now. But this war has been going on from the beginning, and now we're in this age of information where you can go out and get this information. You know, you start looking at it and seeing it, and we're still at war now. There's a war going on between this satanic race and ourselves. And people say, well, that's a load of rubbish. But when Jesus was in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, the devil offered him all the kingdoms of the earth. Right?
Yeah.
Now, if the devil didn't have dominion over the earth or have power over the earth, how could he offer him all them kingdoms? Because the devil rewards you with worldly possessions. That's why all the evil people are rich. Right?
Okay.
God rewards you with heavenly rewards. Yeah?
Okay.
So your reward will come after this life. Yeah? Yeah? And there's another story about that. A demon in the Muslim language is called the jinn. Yeah, and it's known as whirlwinds that come in the desert and all this kind of thing. But they're just a basic demon.
Yeah, that's the Sirocco's, isn't it?
Yeah, well, what the Bedouin used to do is they used to burn incense and stuff like that and try to get the jinns to come over. And they let them possess them for a small, you know, for a short time and let them breathe in all this incense. So when the Bedouin go away, they'd find something of enrichment afterwards. Yeah? Now, this story has been told in the Arabian Nights, with Aladdin.
Yeah?
Yeah? The lamp. Now, you know, the genie of the lamp is the demon. Now, he will grant you wishes.
What if he wants?
Yeah, but he wants to possess you.
Okay.
Right? So he basically got, like, you know, 3 turns of him possessing you. But if he ever gets out of that lamp, he will possess you completely, and he will now control you. Yeah?
Okay.
And that's why Aleister Crowley and all these devil worshippers and all that used to do these rituals to try and
get the powers.
Yeah, but also to imprison the demon, you know, to capture the demon so the demon couldn't get to affect them. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's what it's all about. It's material gains and all this. Everything you see on the telly, you know, the adverts and all this stuff in your face. If you see the film The Matrix, you've got Morpheus and Neo walking down the street. And Morpheus is going on about, you know, the policeman who works for the state and saying, you won't change him because he's too indoctrinated into the society. And then you see a guy who's fumbling about, looking at, you know, worried about everything in the world. He said, there's no point in trying to tell him about the things that are going on in the world because he's got too much on his mind already.
Because he's worried about his investments or his mortgage or his job.
And then he gets to the next person that's going along, and he said, "Well, there's no." He said, "You'll probably tell that guy. He'll probably listen to you, but it will probably be so hurtful to him that he's being lied to all this time that it would take no notice of you whatsoever." But as he's doing this, this woman in red walks past, and Neo turns his head. So Morpheus turns around to him and says, "Was you listening to me, or was you watching the woman in red?" Now, the woman in red is the symbolism of the temptation of Satan.
Okay.
Which you like. Sex, your money, you know, your pop music, your drugs and all that. That temptation that walked past that took his thoughts away for 1 minute is what you're faced with every single day of your life. And when you get to the other film with Keanu Reeves, and I've just explained it in movies because people watch movies, but the person in The Devil's Advocate, when Al Pacino's the devil, trying to entice him, he uses the woman in red. He uses this woman to entice him all the time, you know, through lust and desire.
Yeah, but that's using these esoteric symbolism in popular culture to entrap us into thinking that we have no control, or...
But wait, no, it's just your mind's being dragged away all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
which is my, you know, comes back to my point or my question is that, you know, the Acephalon and the, you know, the Hollow Planet and, you know, the fourth planet that was destroyed and the shape-shifting lizards and all that. When people hear this sort of thing, they tend to go, "Ah, it's a bunch of bull," and move away. But if you look at the esoteric religions and the way that symbolism is used by the ruling elites of the world, it actually becomes apparent that that is what they believe.
Yeah, but like you're going on about the Hollow Earth and you're going on about the shape-shifting aliens, they're not something I believe in.
No, I'm not saying for a moment that you do, but what I'm saying is that what happens is that a lot of this stuff gets wrapped up in that.
Yeah.
But then it takes people's, you know, it's a good escape, but it doesn't actually deal with what's really going on, which is the battle between good and evil, which is what you're trying to get to.
Yeah, and the thing is, you see, everything I've done, I can back up with archaeological evidence. You know what I mean? It's not something I can say, you know, you can just go and Google yourself about the giants and you can see the bone in Turkey. You can go and see the New York Times reports from the 1920s, the 1930s about these giants. You can go and read the Roman historian Tacitus and read about the story about the Roman general being taken into the cave. You know what I mean? These are things where I can give you sort of 100 references to that particular subject. I can also go on about the Cain story from The Life of Adam, which was a book that was removed from the Bible at the Council of Nicaea. You can also go and look at it again from the Book of Jubilees.
Okay, can I just throw you a wild card in here?
Go.
We've got this absolute scourge of the universe, which is pedophilia. And, you know, the whole thing with the, you know, Catholic Church controlling what doctrines are put out and what books are put out. And the, you know, the Vatican is known as one of the, you know, suppositories or repositories of the world's largest pornography libraries. And a few months ago, the Vatican Public Library was closed forever by the now current Pope. And when we go back and look at these old books, if we were able to, we might get the truth, or we might get, you know, a filter of the truth from the 7th century or the 12th or the 16th or 18th century. When you're looking at these documents in the archaeological sense, are the documents, are they peer-reviewed, or are they some guy's website? You know what I mean?
No, they're all peer-reviewed, and you can... there's a great site. I mean, I know it by the medieval source, but other people can go on there, and it has other religious documents on there as well. But everyone... it's like the Life of Adam, which you just done. There was a Slavonic version, there was a Latin version, there was an English, you know, version, and there was a Greek version, and each one of them have been translated, you know what I mean? But there were four actual versions of that one, and I read all four of them.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's not something I've just...
I'm not for a moment suggesting that you're spouting off, but I'm just trying to, for the listeners to get a sense of, you know, if you're looking at peer-reviewed documents that are coming out of an archaeological department, say the University of Salford or the University of Turin, or whether these are, you know, some guy writing, you know, in his lockup in, you know, Wisconsin, right? That's all I'm trying to ask is,
My research is pretty renowned. I mean, it took me 7 years to write Knights of God, which was a story of the First Crusade.
One of the things that I've found out over the, you know, as I get older, is that generally if something has footnotes, that means that somebody's actually put effort in. In your current book or your latest book, do you have a lot of footnotes? Do you have a lot of references?
I've got all the biblical references, but they're not actually as well. You know, like it's not like a guide at the back, you know, of all the different books I've researched from. Mm. But each passage that's in the book, I put, you know, exactly where I got that passage from.
Okay.
One of the interesting, really interesting ones was a quote by General Cornwallis after the surrender, you know, during the American War of Independence. And that was from his chronicler, coming from a book called The Legions of Satan. Even Cornwallis then even said, you know, at the surrender, he said, you think you've won, you may think you've got away from the crown, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But he said, you are now still under the control of the crown, and you now are under the all-seeing eye of the architect of Freemasonry, and that will now control your country for the next 200 years before they destroy you completely. And that was in General Cornwallis in 1776.
You've written these books and you've written these movies, or you're producing this movie with the understanding that by showing the manipulations that go on in our communities and our lives and our world, that we have the power to make a difference, we have the power to change. Whether you believe in all the backstory or not, the fact of the matter is that as individuals and as human beings, if we can come together and work collaboratively, then we do have the power to change. I guess that's what I'm getting from the, you know, the talk we've had today, right?
Well, look, yeah, and that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get us all, as a better society. You know, let's start looking after one each other. The governments are no longer willing to look after us, so let's just start looking after each other. I just want to say my website is actually called authorrobertwakefield.com.
And that's all one word.
Yeah, and I will be putting some pictures up of some of the stuff I've talked about tonight, there's links to all my other books. But I'm not here to sell books. I'm just here. I'm just saying I want to try and get information out to people, And also, I'm going to have a forum once Satan in the City comes out. I'm going to put a forum up on the website
so that people discuss what's written in the book.
Well, yeah, and also, let's collect pictures from all over the world, because I've actually broke a couple of codes that are going to be revealed in the book, which are quite secret at the moment. And so once the book's out and once we start collecting information, people can say, OK, I've seen this symbolism and you've told me what it's meant, but I can then tell you, you know, with these codes, you can even learn even more about them. Which is going to be quite fascinating. This book called Satan in the City is going to be a guidebook for the future. Okay. You're going to be able to get this book, go into some old, like Knights Templar church, or you're going to go to some Masonic temple, and you're going to be able to decipher and decode everything that's on the walls and in the bricks outside.
And from that, with that knowledge, then we're able to effect change in our communities as opposed to being manipulated and controlled by these secret societies. That's the intent.
Well, it's, from my point of perspective, God said no one will, you know, ever be able to withhold the truth. The truth will always come out.
Yeah.
Yeah? Right? So, you know, once the truth's out and everybody knows the truth, when there's no lies in the world and there's no figure, then everyone knows where they stand. You know if that person's a good person or a bad person, don't you? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's basically everybody's getting unclothed and being shown, you know, for what they really are. There's another thing as well, something really curious that I've seen, which I found quite funny. But there's a guy over here called Banksy who does pictures and that.
Yeah, I think we're aware of Banksy. We do know about him over here in the Antipodes of Canada.
Yeah. Well, there's a disused Masonic lodge in Leeds, and I was going past there the other day, and someone like Banksy, might have even been Banksy, that actually drew the Reservoir Dogs picture outside, you know, on the Masonic lodge.
Did you get a picture of it and post it, or did you get a picture?
I didn't have my camera with me at the time, which was really good.
You're going to have to run over to Leeds and get that
before
local council paints it out.
Yeah, well, it's probably gone now because this was a few months ago, but it was like, I just made me laugh. It just symbolised everything that's going on, didn't it?
Okay, mate.
So, So, Andy, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah.
It's fantastic being on your show. I hope people of Canada can understand my Salford accent, but it's been, you know, if you've enjoyed listening to me and all that, I've enjoyed, you spending your time to listen to a piece of me.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, you're more than welcome. This is the end of the world news. This, you keep saying the night because it's nighttime where you are and it's daytime, Sunday afternoon when we're recording this, but... it's good to have you on the show again, and I'll make some links for people, and author robertwakefield.com. You can love him, hate him, believe him or disbelieve him, but he is a force to be reckoned with. I'm going to stop the recording, Bob. Feels a bit like we've been in an episode of Coast to Coast meets George Norrie meets what's the other one? I'm trying to think, you know, like a David Icke episode or something. We're going to do more, obviously. We have to get back on and talk about the Nibiru and, you know, the fourth planet and whether the moon's hollow.
Well, there's some of the things I don't believe in, but...
Yeah, everything... No, but I mean, I want to get your opinion on them, right?
Well, you see, my opinion is I do it with research.
Go ahead. So,
if I can find the links and I can find the archaeological facts and stuff like that.
Okay. The whole point of what you're doing is to try and get away from the mystical and the weird and base it on documentation.
Yeah, well, documentation. Well, there's a couple of things, you know, I talked about tonight about the Hyksos going to Greece. And last year in Santorini, an island off Greece, there was a war relief. And it actually shows this voyage of all the ships leaving and stuff like that. There's a guy called Heinrich Schillemann, a very famous German archaeologist who discovered the city of Troy. He also discovered Agamemnon's mask, which was hidden under a pyramid. But the thing about that is now they've actually dated the site, and it's 300 years before Agamemnon. And inside, this, underneath this pyramid mound, you've got Israeli and Egyptian swords from the past.
Okay.
You know what I mean? This is another symbol to say that the Danans were, actually were there in Macedonia before Agamemnon existed. In fact, Agamemnon was probably a descendant or relative of these Danans that came over there.
Okay.
So, you know, so it's sort of like stuff that, we've been told things in history, but there is a thing called the Rockefeller Institution that, like, own the Dead Sea Scrolls, that actually got the Holy Grail from Antioch in about the 1950s, I believe, this silver chalice, and they go around and they purchase things all over the world to make sure that we don't see them.
Okay.
Yeah.
On that note, we'll end on this one, but we'll continue this talk maybe in a month or so. We'll do it again. Because it's been a lot of fun for me, and you'll be closer to, getting the book out. That's all right, mate. It's the cutout. The author, Robert Wakefield, is the chap we've been listening to. I'm now going to have to do a couple of hours of editing to make this into a saleable item. But I'm going to cut the record, but we'll keep chatting, mate. Coming back. Okay, we're back, Bob. Now, we've got a couple of records to play that are going to be hopefully in the movie. We've got the Sham 69 with their... What was their track?
Well, Sham 69 were kind enough to do the theme music for the Year Zero, and it was sent to us by one of their, main guys called Ian Whitewood. He just got in touch with me out of the blue after coming across the website, seeing what we was up to, seeing what we were doing, and he said, "Hey Robert," he said, "I've wrote this theme music for you. Anyway, you can listen to it now, and I can tell you this will blow your mind away." called Saviour. He's by a guy called George Pappas. He's from Australia. And he now calls himself Alien Skin. And all I want to do is everything we talked about tonight about the devil and all that kind of stuff. Well, when you listen to this song, just remember that the angels and prophets of the Lord are now amongst you. So there's nothing to worry about. All the good guys now seem to be winning. You might seem a bit desperate at the moment, and there might seem to be like trying times. Well, listen to this song and just uplift your spirit.
Okay, so that's, what's it called again? Alien?
It's Saviour by Alien Skin.
Okay, Saviour by Alien Skin. Last one, Bob. The third song, should I say?
Yeah. This song is by a band called Loudmouth. They're based in Newcastle in the UK. They're a bit of a punk rock band. This song's called 10%. And what it basically is you know, when these people are getting you down, you've still got that 10% in you, you know, that's still inside you, that's willing to say, you know, I'm here,
not taking
I'm alive.
It anymore.
Yeah, and you're not going to affect me.
Yeah.
So listen to this song and just get your soul
revived. So on a positive note, I'll just...
No need to say sorry when you just don't mean it. There's no need to pray. No need to pray when you don't believe in it. If you have nothing worthwhile to say, nothing to say, they just don't say it. What are you heading not and worry about? Look beyond the sexes and on this planet. No one really knows. It won't be it. Limitations, I don't respect a minority of people. The ones I know the most are the ones that we see as insane. Beyond the wall, that's another world. There's no work for this one. Just use your imagination and creativity with it. Just use your head now. Make sure you use it well. Let your wisdom guide you all the way.
CITR 101.9 FM. It's 7 minutes to 4 in the AM. I figured that was we should play that late night because of some of the subject matter, and I didn't think it would work at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. So that's Robert Wakefield, the author, from the movie and the book The Year Zero. And that can be found at arthurrobertwakefield.com. Links off my site. That is on, if you go to End of the World News on Facebook, End of the World News Radio on Facebook, there's links there. And also on DJ Goulash at YouTube, the channel, is a link to my blog where there's a Year Zero page and this show if you want to go download it in its entirety without me talking over. And that's kind of where that is. Now, the other day, a gentleman by the name of Malcolm McLaren left us. So I'm just setting up. We're going to have, at 4 a.m. till 6 or 7, about 3 hours of intense electronica from the Compact label in Germany and other such things. But first, something is jumping in my shirt.
Listen, you're a beautiful girl.
Do you really think so?
True perfection.
But can I do it?
Take it to the ball, and on that runway, walk the body.
Oh, it's hurting just because love is growing.
McLaren, Something Jumping in My Shirt, apparently featuring Bootsy Collins and introducing, I think it was Lyra, but I'm not sure, on that kind of same note, because the thing about Mr. McLaren was in the morning I'm going to do an Art of Noise thing and talk more about it, but here's something that was kind of along those same lines. Here's David Sylvian with Mr. Merry Christmas from the Bowie and stuff. One of the classics. Kind of Buffalo Girls into the opera and stuff. It's one of the most beautiful pieces of pop music ever. Sylvian's brilliant. It's almost 4 a.m. This is the end of the world news. I have to fix the podcast.